This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, the true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respects to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 18th of November, 2025, and thank you to the Radioactive Show 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio today we've got Fiza and Elena. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
How are we? How was our weekend?
It was great. It was lovely. I joined the Run for Palestine, so that was fun. Yeah, it was huge. I think it was like the biggest one they've done so far. The biggest turnout they've had.
Can you tell us more about it?
Oh, I don't know. it was a fundraiser for Olive for Kids, for sure. Yeah, and then it was just laps around the 10, which was quite lovely. And I guess with the weekly rallies not being on anymore, it was just, I guess, another excuse for community to come together spend time together. So it was nice. Yeah, a lot of children, a lot running around. It was just too bad about the weather, but it turned out okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Did you do more running or more walking?
Not at all. Yeah, that was my joke because I met up with, like, obviously, with my friends. We were just like, it's not a run for Palestine. It's a walking for Palestine. And it's around the Botanic Garden. So you're enjoying the beautiful birds and bees and the scenery.
That's nice. Yeah. Elena, how are you?
I'm good. I'm definitely not a runner, why I asked, because I run when I'm chased.
Exactly.
That's about it. but I'm good. I'm almost done with uni, which is very exciting. Yay. Cannot wait to be done. Counting down the days.
Yeah.
But it's exciting. I have my grad show soon. So hopefully after that, then I'll be done.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah, that's really exciting.
How are you?
Yeah, good. I just feel like things are sort of wrapping up in many different ways. Yeah. And we're getting to the end. Although, at the same time, it feels like things are not slowing down
exactly
either. Elena and I are currently learning Auslan, which is really good. We obviously, our listeners can't see us. We'll probably be practicing during
Definitely.
Try to.
Trying to find events, maybe.
To do,
in the community.
That's a
great skill to pick up.
So that's going well. But we'll keep you posted. but for now, let's chat about what's happening on today's show, because it is a pretty big show this morning. So we're starting off by talking to Jay Underwood, who is the music manager and community connector behind Liberate, which is a grassroots initiative uplifting indie and emerging creatives across NAM. And they'll be on the show to talk about a fundraising gig for Switchboard, which is a community-based non-for-profit providing peer-driven and support service for LGBTIQA plus communities and their allies, friends, support workers and family. So that's coming up first. Then we'll be speaking to Juliet Lamont, who is a documentary filmmaker and frontline activist. And she was recently on the global Samud flotilla making its way to Gaza. But she'll be joining us on the show to talk about Ferra Engineering in Brisbane and their involvement in manufacturing parts for the F-35 jets. So that's coming up at 7:30. And then at 7:45, we'll be joined by Sophie Ellis, who is manager of the criminal law practice at Youth Law. And she'll be on the show to talk about the Victorian government's newly proposed adult time for violent crime bill and how these laws will harm young people in Victoria.
And then we'll be chatting to Jess Hudson and Zara O'Day, the co-curators of the upcoming exhibition Rest in Power, Jess Hutchinson's program coordinator at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, and Sarah O'Day is an artist with a socially engaged practice.
And finally, at 8:15, we'll be joined by Kath from the Defend Dissent Coalition, speaking about the Victorian government's newly introduced justice legislation amendment, the proposed anti-protest laws.
Yeah, so there's so much happening on this morning's show, and just like a running theme of, I guess, like new laws across the board being proposed for Victoria, and how they're going to impact on our rights, but also the future of young people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. So stay tuned. We'll be back with the news headlines in just a moment.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 18th November 2025. Senator Lydia Thorpe is calling on Attorney General Michelle Rowland to immediately release the Standing Council of Attorneys General bail and remand reform working group report, completed in July but still being withheld from the public. The national report, which was produced by officials from every jurisdiction and First Nations representatives, reportedly urges governments to move away from punitive bail laws. Several states are now seeking to suppress the document ahead of the SCAG meeting in Brisbane. According to reporting in The Australian, which has received a leaked report, it recommends unwinding punitive bail laws, scrapping standalone breach of bail offences, and reinstating the fundamental principle that imprisonment should be a last resort, particularly for children. Senator Thorpe says the onus is now on Attorney General Rowland and the Minister for Indigenous Australians to stand up against the states and territories attempting to bury the evidence that their policies do not follow expert advice and are breaching human rights. Also in the news, the Israeli military has killed at least three Palestinians in Gaza as the coastal enclave reeled from heavy rains flooding shoddy makeshift tents housing thousands who have been denied adequate shelter owing to Israel's continued throttling of aid supplies. An Al Jazeera source at Nasir Medical Complex reported on Sunday that three people had been killed after Israel bombed east of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. That same day, Israel also struck Gaza City's Zaytun neighborhood and areas close to the southern city of Rafah. Reporting from Gaza City, Al Jazeera's Ibrahim Al-Khalil said the Israeli army was still targeting locations inside the so-called Yellow Line, which demarcates where troops have withdrawn as part of the ceasefire. Al-Khalil said the situation was going from bad to worse for families living near the Yellow Line, as the military continued to demolish residential buildings and spread panic while they contended with heavy rains flooding makeshift shelters.
In other news, a Bangladesh court has sentenced ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to death on Monday, concluding a months-long trial that found her guilty of ordering a deadly crackdown on a student-led uprising last year. The ruling is the most dramatic legal action against a former Bangladeshi leader since independence in 1971, and comes just ahead of the parliamentary elections elected to be held in early February. Hasina's Awami League party has barred from contesting as it is feared that Monday's verdict could stoke fresh unrest ahead of the vote. The International Crimes Tribunal, Bangladesh's domestic wartime court, delivered the verdict amid tight security and Hasina's absence. She has fled to India in August of 2024 and at the height of the uprising against her government. Hasina got a life sentence under charges with crimes against humanity and the death sentence for the killing of several people during her uprising. Her son, advisor Sajib Wasid, told Reuters on the eve of the verdict that they would not appeal unless the democratically elected government took office with the Awami League participation. Finally, in the headlines, a new report on the youth detention in Queensland has confirmed that children are being tortured inside youth prisons. The 2025 Youth Detention Centre inspection report released by the Queensland Ombudsman revealed that children are being held in isolation, are subject to dangerous restraints, and are denied access to education, connection, and culture. The report outlines that Queensland is breaching Article 37 of the UN Convention on the Rights of Child and Section 10 of the Human Rights Act Queensland. The Ombudsman also found that the children in youth detention were disproportionately Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. CEO of Sisters Inside, Debbie Kilroy, commented on the findings of the report. For decades, Sisters Inside has warned governments that children's prisons are inherently violent institutions where abuse is not an aberration. It is everyday operating environment. This report confirms exactly that. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, the 18th of November, 2025. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo! Woo!
But I won't be sworn at and I won't be bossed around. That includes them, the big bosses. They won't be bossing me around either. I will find a way.
Rents are through the roof. The cost of living is skyrocketing and public housing is under attack. How do we fight back? Join us on Wednesday, the 26th of November from 6 p.m. at RMIT University's City Campus for From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice, a free public event that gets to the heart of the housing struggle. Featuring the premiere of Bay Views for All, a documentary about the fight to save the Barrack Beacon public housing estate, and a panel discussion with public housing residents, activists, and experts, this is one you won't want to miss. Register for a free ticket at events.humanitix.com/crisis-2-justice.
It's never occurred to them they've actually got something valuable here.
End of public housing! End of public housing! End of public housing!
A 3CR supporter.
Hopefully we can protect everything that's worth protecting on country and keep all warmongers out.
Well, I won't back down.
Coogatha elder Aunty Sue Hasseldine is fighting to protect her country from Southern Launch's rocket testing range. Southern Launch's collaborations with international weapons companies such as Thales, as well as the Australian Defence Force, are threatening sacred sites, endangered animals, and unique ecosystems.
Stand my ground.
Join West Mallee Protection, letter writing calling on key decision makers to get Sun Launch off Gugatha Country. For more information, visit West Mallee Protection on Instagram. West Mallee Protection is a 3CR supporter. And I won't back
down. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. And we are now joined by Jay Underwood, who is the music manager and community connector behind Liberate, a grassroots initiative uplifting indie and emerging creatives across the NAR music community. They join us on 3CR Breakfast this morning to discuss the upcoming fundraising event for Switchboard, which is a community-based, non-for-profit organization that provides peer-driven support service for LGBTIQA plus communities and their allies, friends, support workers and families. Welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Jay.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. I was wondering if you could start by telling our listeners more about Liberate Community, how it was started and what it's all about.
Absolutely. So Liberate has kind of been simmering away for me for the last nearly 7 years, but it wasn't until a lot of circumstances aligned, or more so the universe kicked me in the behind. In February, I changed jobs, and it meant it was a perfect scenario for me to align my youth and community development skills with 12 years of being in the music industry, coming up through the grassroots and through youth-funded programs as well. So I've done a lot of work personally with young people 12 to 25, and I've seen a lot of value in the work I've done that isn't limited by age range or government funding. And so we're attempting it at the grassroots in a fully DIY capacity, and I can feel a lot of people resonating with the community-first, artist-first approach to how we do things, and only, you know, cherry-picking industry practices that uplift musicians and creatives in the music community.
Yeah, and especially at a time when industries like the music industry and the arts sector, there's little funding for people who are just beginning, for local artists, or the music industry can be really intense or restricting, and there's a focus on, you know, like capitalism, and there's an agenda and things like that. Why is it important to have collectives and organizations like Liberate that are really focused on community?
Well, something I really love about Liberate right now, it doesn't, it's not fully established, which is very intentional. I want to make sure that any form of establishment that might have to do with business is done with intention, because keeping the power as close to the ground and keeping a management structure as flat as possible is so important, because some of the biggest concerns are the gatekeeping and, you know, the roll-on implications of trying to pursue music under capitalism. And right now Liberate's in a position where I am proud of what we put forward can't be bought. We don't charge a fee for service, and anyone who even makes a playlist is asked to do it and encouraged and inspired to do it from being a taste maker and not because it's going to help them social climb. And I think that the word authentic gets thrown around a lot alongside community, and I think that it's the authenticity, or more so the humanity, that is really resonating with people, because that's the breath of fresh air. There's a lot of elements of the industry that refer to themselves as networks or communities, but it's showing up in that way with that as the primary intention that really makes it different, and I think so important to the people who connect with it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I spent a bit of time just looking at your social media because I just learned about you recently, and just seeing things like venue access guides and, information that allows for everyone to access these gigs and events is so important. And you put on so many different type of community events. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that. And yeah, like you said, going back to that idea of being really intentional about how you go about things and making sure that it is for everyone.
Absolutely. And the access guide that's just gone up is for our event on Friday. It's something that I do before all of our presented or co-presented shows, along with, I guess, some of the intention around community access and inclusion just sort of goes hand in hand with that. You know, if you're centering the humans, you've got to center their humanness. So I've seen a lot through working in the local government space in structured community services that access and inclusion is something that's resourced, but some of the simplest ways that you can be accessible in an event is just radical honesty. You don't have to get it perfect. If the event's partially accessible or fully accessible, you've just got to be honest so that people can make informed decisions. You've got to respect the dignity of risk for people to show up as they are and who they are in community. But you need to make sure that they're being honest and they're not being surprised when they arrive somewhere and feeling not welcomed in, because the last thing I want is for Liberate to be portrayed that way. I want everything, every communication to feel like an invite.
Yeah.
So that's really intentional when it comes to access and inclusion, and just based on like asking a couple of little questions when people book tickets. I know that Liberate is mostly 18 to 35 who are queer and neurodivergent, and as someone who identifies with all of those things, I'm glad I'm resonating with the people that I intend it to resonate with. And I think that just showing that you don't need all of these resources and a huge ledger line of budget to put on things that support people, and that you also don't need to get it perfect to, you know, be accessible, just communicating that information is so important. Yeah, I think that's the main thing behind why we do things the way we do. I think, and then looking at the digital community as an accessibility lens as well, like through an accessibility lens as well, we do a lot of consultation. So if we're going to put up a post, I'll send DMs to some of our most highly engaged people who are booking shows or who are releasing music, and I try to bring all of the information to a centralized place so that people have an idea of good practice. It's not gatekept behind, ooh, can't share this contact because I might not get benefit from it next time, or, oh, I can't share this information because I'm not actually sure if I'm correct. It's like, oh, well, this is checked alongside with a whole bunch of other people, and this is the best a lot of people can do. So I think you're doing just fine, and people reshare a lot of those more infographic posts because it gives them a bit of a northern star with what can feel really daunting in the music industry as doing it alone.
Yeah, definitely. You've touched on so many things there, but yeah, I really just like the idea of being radically honest. And like you said, it's really not that hard. Like, I'm looking at the access guide that you've created for the Queer Pink fundraiser that we'll chat about in just a moment. And yeah, there's lots of information on there, which just goes to show that, you know, for smaller upcoming collectives and communities like Liberate, if you guys can do it, you know, there's no excuse for huge venues and businesses, organisations with lots of funding and lots of resources to do it as well.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the fundraiser for Switchboard that's happening on Friday. Can you tell us more about some of the acts that will be there, where it's going to be held, and why this fundraiser for Switchboard?
So I guess Switchboard represents something that a lot of the lineup and also the venue all have in common, and it's being a safe space for queer people. So it made sense in terms of speaking to Enzo, the band who have really been driving, putting this together and supporting Welcome, Stranger Events and Liberate to put this on. It really came down to representing who we are and our community. And I think one thing all of the acts have in common is knowing that when you have a platform, you need to do something with it. And so collecting Switchboard was personal but also collective. For me, on a personal note, I know that when I felt lost as a youth worker in adulthood with my identity, services that Switchboard has delivered has supported me, and I've also worked with the Rainbow Community Angels to deliver youth drag events. And so when I did that, they didn't invoice, they never got paid for their work, and no matter how many times I asked while I was still in that job. So being able to give back in this way feels full circle and feels like the give and take that community, the reciprocity that community is built on. And I think that Gummo is Cafe Gummo in Thornbury is somewhere a lot of people feel safe. It's queer first, it's community first, it's anti-fascist, and everything aligns with the types of people that are going to want to celebrate this event with us. I invited a mutual friend along, and they were going to invite someone that they have a crush on, and that person was already coming. So it's really nice to hear those little stories alongside all of the intentions that line up along the way to get there.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that sounds like it's going to be an incredible event. If people would like to find out more, where can they go to, read up about the venue and how can they purchase tickets?
So you could purchase tickets by going to Cafe Gummo's website, but also if you go to liberate.community on Instagram, at that latest post also tags all of the artists so that you can find them. Supertart, Heterophobes, Sylvie Gunn are also joining us for the night. So please follow along with them. And, of course, if there's any updates to access information, will be communicated there too.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jay, for joining us on the show this morning to speak more about Liberate, the community that you're building, but also the fundraiser. It sounds like it's going to be a great event, and we'll pop all the details in our show notes today.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and enjoy your morning.
So we've been speaking to Jay Underwood from Liberate, who joined us on the show to talk about the upcoming fundraising gig for Switchboard. The gig is this Friday, the 21st of November, from 8 p.m. to 11:30 at Cafe Gummo, which is 711 High Street, Thornbury. And as Jay said just now, you can go to liberate.community on Instagram to find out more. And we will pop those details in our show notes. But for now, we are going to go to a song. Supertart is a feminist girl punk band from Lutruwita playing on the Southern Lands of the Kulin Nation, and they will be playing at the Queer Punk Fundraiser this Friday. And this is their song called Maxine's Garden. We'll be right back. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and that was the song Maxine's Garden by Supertap. We are now joined on the line by Juliette Lamont, who is a documentary filmmaker and a frontline activist for all of the intersectional struggles for justice and equality, including Indigenous sovereignty, climate, human rights, native forests, and Palestine. She was recently on the Global Smud Flotilla to deliver aid in an attempt to break the illegal siege on Gaza. And Juliette joins us on the program to discuss the IOF's use of F-35 jets and the parts of these weapons that are being produced at Farah Engineering in Brisbane. Welcome back to 3CR, Juliette.
Hi, yeah, it's great to be back. It's great to be back. Good to be out of an Israeli occupation force jail. So, you know, everything's good at the moment.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I know that a Monday Breakfast spoke to Subi Awad yesterday about this. So I was wondering if you could give us your perspective and reflections on the recent or the ongoing actions against Farah. Can you tell us more about this company and their involvement or their complicity in the genocide in Palestine?
Yeah, well, I think you know, a lot of people in so-called Australia don't realise that there's probably over 70 manufacturers of integral parts global, you know, that actually are like the only parts that supply the F-35 fighter jets. So without these integral parts, there would be no ability for these death machines to drop these 2,000-pound bombs on innocent Palestinians. So a lot of activists and anti-genocide supporters are doing everything that they can to name and shame these companies. Farah specifically makes a piece that's an adapter, so it kind of it releases these bombs. So without that one part, you know, those bombs would not be falling on Gaza. So it's a really constructive and directed and efficient way to stop the genocide. So we need more people to do it. And a lot of people, that's the thing, it's in their backyard and they don't know anything about it. It just looks like a very kind of benign industrial factory, but it's not whatsoever. So, yeah, we're trying to get the word out and get more people involved in the struggle.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of these companies have, I guess, done a really good job of trying to, I guess, launder their image through programs in schools and, you know, focusing on like jobs, economy, technology without actually talking about their involvement in weapons manufacturing per se. And so, do you think that slowly there is this awareness, more of an awareness among people in so-called Australia about what's happening? Or do you think there's still, the message is still sort of not getting out there?
I mean, I don't think the message is getting out there enough. And then I think when it does, when you look at PAL Action in the UK, they were so successful in targeting Elbit, which is probably one of the worst culprits, really, in terms of supporting with their, you know, sort of weapons research, which are in universities in so-called Australia also. But, you know, they were so good at smashing these factories and targeting planes, and you know that now they've been prescribed as a terrorist group, and the Felton 24 are still in prison. I think their I think that court case came up yesterday. These are young students who just cannot watch a live stream genocide anymore and took it in their own hands to actually smash the war machine and looked at the kind of pushback politically. You know, they've been put in prison and they're not terrorists whatsoever. So I do think that feel like there's also a fear here that those laws might come into effect. But while we're in this sweet spot, while they're not, I encourage everybody, without probably my lawyers would say probably don't say that. But, find out where these declassifieds are. Really good organisation. You can look them up. They can tell you where these genocide supporting weapons manufacturers are, and you know, get together in community groups, reach out. There's normally Palestine groups in, you know, wherever you live, and find out, you know, you can picket them, you can escalate like we normally do and get on the roof and refuse to come down, you can lock on, which we've done recently. Just keep hammering them and keep telling the wider public that we don't want this death manufacturers in the places that we live.
And you recently were on the Global Smud Flotilla, so I was wondering if you could briefly describe your experiences there and your encounter with these parts or these weapons, these fighter jets, during your experience?
Yeah, well, it's like been 500 people from all around the world, humanitarians and activists and parliamentarians and novelists and bus drivers and students, you know, from all around the world, from 46 countries. And we spent about 3 weeks getting all of these vessels seaworthy, just, you know, sailing boats or bigger boats, and Barcelona, Crete, Sicily and Tunis were all of our departure points. We all met around Crete, and, you know, a lot of the intimidation tactics from the Israeli occupation forces was to fly these F-35s over us, you know, and as a so-called Australian, knowing that, you know, parts that, you know, that they were working because they were parts made in the country in which I, the stolen land in which I live in, was made me feel absolutely repulsed. We got about 20 nautical miles away from the shores of Gaza. We could see it. We had aid. We had critical aid and baby food and medicine and everything that the Israeli forces were not letting in by land. So it was a really bittersweet thing in that it was the largest historically flotilla ever. We got the closest, but we still couldn't get close enough to deliver the much-needed food. And when we were intercepted and handcuffed and taken into an Israeli prison, you could hear those F-35s just swoop right over the prisons that we were in, knowing we were only about 20 k's from Gaza, knowing exactly what they were just about to do. So it was horrific knowing that we're complicit in the slaughter and murder of innocent Palestinians and have been 4 years, and the weapons industry, the two-way weapons industry in this country is something that we're really invested in, that Albo completely denies, and we need to make him be honest and, sanction Israel, embargo all trade with Israel, and stop the weapons supply now because it's sick. And, you know, do we want... Yeah, we don't... Most, I think it's like 86% of people that live in this country don't want to be part of this genocide, so he really needs to listen to his voters.
Yeah. And so can you give us an update on the actions outside the Farah weapons factory? I know that community members, including yourself, shut it down last week, but are there ongoing actions this week? Where can people go to find out more?
There will be a lot. So Rising Tide is mostly climate, but they are sort of making the connection between climate justice and extractivism and colonialism. I mean, I think we've already known it, but and also the weapons industry and genocide, and that killing, you know, killing on that scale creates, you know, really terrible, you know, sort of climate catastrophe. So they've got Palestinian panels going on, and without giving too much away, I'd say that would be a really good place to go, because there might be some really interesting actions around that after that.
Yeah, and then for people who are wanting to educate themselves and learn more about Australia's ties to weapons manufacturing, aside from Declassified, have you got any other resources or tips for people so that they can educate themselves and get involved?
Yeah, well, there's some great NAM-based direct action. So WACA is a really good, so look WACA up. I think they're AKA WACA on Instagram, AKA dot and then WACA, I think. I'm not sure. Disrupt Wars is another sort of effective platform that have been trying to smash the industrial war machine for decades. Wage Peace is up in Mianjin. Just reach out, just get into just to message them, and they have an array of evidence, documentation, even a really easy list.
Yeah.
I think it might be something that I could put on my Instagram, because I went to the flotilla with about 30 mates, mostly like my kids, and now I've sort of got quite a few, so that's quite funny. But yeah, anyway, reach out to me. It's just Juliet Lamont, all run, and I can find the list of exactly where these weapons factories are, and suggestions of how you can, you know, picket or lobby or, you know, smash things or get on roofs or, you know, do whatever you want that you feel is right to finally end our complicity in this genocide.
Well, thank you so much, Juliet, for joining us on the show this morning. I think, I mentioned in your introduction that, you're all about fighting for the intersectional struggles, and I think that's something that's really important and to come back to time and time again, is that all these struggles are connected and that we can stand in solidarity with each other and other communities overseas to fight. So yeah, thank
and
you so much.
Especially like mob. I mean, we really have McBucked this land, and we've stolen it, and we've done everything we can to destroy it. So we have, like, I feel like, an even bigger moral duty to make sure that, you know, we kind of right our wrongs and we just make the world a more equal, kinder and just place for everybody.
Well, on that note, thank you again, Juliet, for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast this morning.
Okay, lovely to talk to you. Take care of yourself.
We've been speaking to Juliet Lamont, who was speaking to us about Farah Engineering's manufacturing of parts made for F-35 jets used in the genocide in Palestine. We are going to play another song now. This one is by Zain, who is a Palestinian-Jordanian artist. Her song Hilwa means beautiful in Arabic and honours her mother, grandmother and Palestinian women in general. It comes from her album Orda, which was released last month.
احلى صوره في عينيا واللي مر في زمان كانوا طواه النسيان وعدي ليكي وحبي ليكي غلى عليا حلوه حلوه وما عليكي كلمه حلوه حلوه وما عليكي كلمه قالبا قلبا ما عليكي كلمه حلوه حلوه
That was Hilwa by Zain,
who is a Palestinian Jordanian artist, and Hilwa means beautiful in Arabic, and it was a song honoring her mother, grandmother, and Palestinian women in general. Up next, we have Sophie Ellis on the line. Sophie Ellis is the manager of the criminal law practice at Youth Law and has been practicing law for over a decade. Youth Law is a statewide community legal service helping children and young people under 24 with a range of legal problems, including summary crime, family violence, fines, and debts. Sophie joins us on the program this morning to discuss the Victorian government's proposed adult time for violent crime bill and how these laws will harm young people in Victoria. Good morning, Sophie. How are you?
Hi, Steva. Good, thanks. Thank you so much for having me on your show this morning.
Oh, all good. It's great to hear from you. So I guess to start us off, could you tell us more about the work that you do at Youth Law?
Yeah, sure. So we're a community legal centre and we provide free legal help for children and young people up to the age of 25 across the state. And we see a lot of kids every year, thousands of kids and young adults who have been, you know, found themselves in really vulnerable situations. A lot of the young people that we support and help have had really tough lives, some of them experiencing homelessness, have experienced family violence. Kids and young people who have had a history of being removed from their families are in the care of child protection, residential out-of-home care, and dealing with, you know, such compounding traumas. Often they're also young people who might have issues with addictions because of trying to manage what they've been through in their lives. And we find that a lot of them have compounding legal harms as well. So we try to wrap around them, link in with other community agencies to support young people to resolve the legacy of these compounding issues, which often end up in the justice system.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. So it's a vicious cycle, isn't it? That, yeah, totally. It keeps reproducing itself. So I guess, yeah, given the work that you do, could you give us an overview of the new Victorian government's adult time for violent crime and how this will impact the young people you've been talking about?
Yeah, thanks, Steva. So the Allan government last week has proposed these new laws, adult time for adult crime, which we will have all heard about. And really, they're pretty gobsmacking because they are laws that would see children age 14 up to 17 potentially sentenced in an adult court rather than the specialist jurisdiction of the children's court. The Allan government is focusing on a range of offences. There's five in particular, which are, you know, serious criminal matters, targeting aggravated carjackings, home invasions, recklessly causing injury. These are all crimes, of course, that have really negative impacts on the community, and we all want to see community harm reduced. But what the proposals are aimed at is sentencing children in adult courts, removing the presumption of jail as a penalty of last resort for children, and also increasing sentences for these range of offenders offences that will see some children potentially exposed to penalties of life imprisonment. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to be proposing without any consultation with our experts in the Victorian community, from community services, Aboriginal services, legal services. And the other really striking thing is that these laws are completely against human rights principles that we have enshrined here in Australia. Yeah. So in Victoria, under our Charter of Human Rights, a child convicted of an offence has to be treated in an age-appropriate way. We're talking about kids here whose brains are not fully developed. And we are removing what we already have, which is, you know, the therapeutic and age-appropriate jurisdiction of the Children's Court. We also have the International Covenant of Children's Rights, which Australia is signatory, and Article 37 of that covenant says that no child should be subject to cruel, inhumane or degrading treatment. We know sending a child to jail will exactly expose them to that.
Exactly, yeah.
And that there shouldn't be life imprisonment for children under 18, and that imprisonment is a measure of last resort and should be only for the shortest time period. So they're incredibly concerning developments and proposals by the Allan government. And they're not going to improve safety, because we know when children are incarcerated and sent to jail, they are removed from their community. We know that children, the earlier they are sent to jail and the earlier they're exposed to the carceral system, the more likely and the earlier they are to, upon release, re-offend. They're not given the therapeutic intervention that they need to make and to address the compounding harms that have got them there in the first place.
Absolutely. And, you mentioned earlier as well, like, you know, there's a lack of consultation with various groups, but particularly I guess I want to pick up on how would this bill impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children specifically, as well as children, you know, from over-policed communities?
Yeah. Well, we know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children are over-policed.
Yeah.
Because of systemic racism in policing practices and, you know, compounding intergenerational trauma since colonisation. They're not the only group that are overrepresented in our criminal justice system. But we know also that since the changes to our remand laws have taken effect, we've had an increase in the remand of vulnerable children in Victoria, exponential. That data has been reported from Victoria Legal Aid. And at the time where the Victorian government has just signed a treaty and just engaged in a four-year systemic inquiry and truth-telling through the Yuruk Commission of Inquiry, this is a devastating blow and really goes against the principles that the Victorian government has committed to as part of treaty. One of the very important inquiries that recommendations that came out of the Yuruk for Justice report was a prohibition of detention of children under 16 and raising the criminal age of responsibility to 14. So these proposed changes go against that. Those recommendations and best practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this proposed laws comes after the recent announcement that the government will be reopening the decommissioned Malmesbury Youth Prison, and also following Christopher Lee's government's harmful youth justice laws in Queensland, which we also see how harmful that has been. The messaging from the government is supposedly keep the community safe. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we've seen a staggering investment, you know, in prisons and policing.
Yeah.
Victorian police received $4.5 billion in the last financial year. Yeah. I mean, it's a huge sum of money.
Exactly.
What we're not seeing is the output of that being increased safety. We're seeing the opposite.
Exactly.
And we're not seeing a similar investment in our community organisations that actually hold these vulnerable children.
Yeah.
So we know prisons don't work.
Yes.
The young people that I've assisted over the years and that Youth Law helps, they have often endured the most unimaginable traumas. And what they really need is direct therapeutic intervention, people to wrap around them and hold, grapple with their trauma, get them re-engaged in school and education, support their families and reconnection with families if that's been severed, where it's safe and appropriate to do so, address if they're victims of crime, address that, get them linked in with counselling, through doing all of those things, and I've seen it happen, kids can begin to heal.
Exactly.
And they can begin to be a really a part of their community again. And what we, I think it's really understandable that, that the community is concerned about crime and, you know, the nature of these crimes is, you know, it's really horrific and it does have significant impacts on victims.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I think we need to take a step back and say, what are we doing wrong here?
Exactly. Yeah.
Why is this happening in the first place?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Get to the root of it. And we've got to go back. Yeah. That's right. We've got to go back to the root of it because any child in jail is a symptom of that child being. It's a symptom of the community being broken. Any child engaging in that kind of crime is a symptom of things not working. And so I think what we do need is really sustained, ongoing funding into our community programs and for our community to reckon with why and what we need to do to ensure that this is not happening in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much, Sophie. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have today, but we will definitely, I'm sure this is going to keep coming up. So we would love to have you back on the show to chat more about this.
Thanks so much, Diva.
Thank you,
Sophie.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We've been speaking to Sophie Ellis, manager of the criminal law practice at Youth Law. You can follow their work by heading to youthlaw.asn.au or at youthlaw.vic on Instagram. Up next, we have a song for you. This is by Isabel Caldwell, a Nam-based musician writing meditative songs delivered with introspection and wit. Her debut album, Duty of Care, garnered love from listeners alongside a 2023 AFMA nomination. This next song is from that album, Here's Across the Hill.
Reach for another. chatting with the co-curators of upcoming exhibition Rest in Power, Jess Hudson, and the program coordinator at the Queen Victoria Women's Centre, Zara Otay, an artist with a social engaged practice. The exhibition, which opens next Tuesday, the 25th of November, will bring together art, activism, and examine on gendered violence in the community in a reflection on last year's RMIT grad show, which protested the deaths of 85 women in 2024. Jess and Zara join us to discuss the context of the exhibition, the role of art in protest, and the importance of the narrative in discussing violence against women. The following conversation will cover sensitive topics such as violence against women. If you need support, please contact 1-800-RESPECT. It is available for free 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to support people impacted by domestic, family, or sexual violence. Welcome to 3CR, Jess and Zara.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
To start off, Zara, could you tell us a little bit about last year's RMIT grad show and how it came to be?
Absolutely. The graduate exhibition for RMIT is a really incredible culmination of all of the students' work. They're allowed to exhibit anything from their 3 years in this degree. It's an opportunity for people to be seen throughout the city, from people in the art scene in Melbourne, curators, exhibition designers, galleries. It's a really important, incredible event that students spend their entire degree and then the weeks leading up to the event working towards painting the exhibition space. It's a really involved process that I've gotten to experience this year as well. In the event last year for 2024, something really incredible happened where one of the students on the second day of the exhibition took her piece down and turned it around, and in its place wrote Isla Bell, 85th woman to be violently murdered in Australia. This act of sacrifice, of removing her visibility from this opportunity, this incredible big exhibition full of students, sparked a change kind of across the campus, across the School of Art, where a whole range of students followed her and turned this into an incredible, powerful ripple where a whole range of students took their artworks off the wall, cut their pieces down, turned them around, placed them on the floor, and in their place wrote pages of text or names or the number 85, which was, Isla Bell was the 85th woman to be killed in Australia. And then halfway through, they came back and scratched that out and wrote 86 because the report had come in again. It was just an incredibly moving kind of act of sacrifice and something that spoke to how important it was to get the message out.
Yeah, wow. Jess, could you tell us why the Queen Victoria Women's Centre felt it was important to restage this exhibition?
Yeah, well, each year we recognise the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, which is a UN initiative. And we thought this year, because this had happened just one year on, and it really was quite an extraordinary moment. I know that people through the arts community and more broadly were kind of like, whoa, this is an interesting thing to see folks acting in solidarity in this way. And it was so quick because the graduate shows only stay up for one week. So it sort of came and it went. And through speaking to other people that work in the sector and the community, there was some awareness that it felt like it would be a valuable thing to revisit. For the community of students that made those actions, but also for Isla's family, who were quite moved by those actions, by those students, and the broader community as well. So this period of time came around. It was 16 days of action, and we wanted to host something that reflected what action can really look like in this space. And we felt like the actions of these students last year was such an extraordinary thing. It really, really felt like it was something we wanted to revisit.
Yeah, definitely. Zara, could you tell us about the content of this exhibition and the conversation it sparks about gendered violence?
Yeah, absolutely. This exhibition is going to be an opportunity for those students and the broader community to revisit the actions that occurred. As Jess said, it's going to present the documentation of what happened, which is really interesting and beautiful because it was all just taken on mobile phones, and it's nothing, it's not a professional sort of curated photography exhibition. It's going to be an incredible collection of written pieces and text messages and photographs, and hopefully an opportunity for those students to come back and have their artworks back in the space as well in a certain way. It's going to be a space in which people can have the opportunity to make placards for the Walk Against Family Violence, which is occurring the day after our opening event on Friday the 28th. It'll be an opportunity for people to respond in the space, to have the chance to actually write something down in the space of the artworks too. It's going to be an incredible event. Did you have anything you wanted to add to that, Jess?
I suppose we just wanted to create an opportunity and sort of hold space for a continuation of action in some form. So people can come and engage, and they can take an orange ribbon out into their communities and tie it up and take a photograph and post it, and or they can make a placard, or they can actually literally write women's names that have died through 2024-25. So engaging in a similar sort of act as the students did, so sort of having that kind of connection between what happened the year before and how you physically kind of do that in public space.
Yeah.
So it's a way of providing an opportunity for a broader community to kind of to come together and to be able to potentially, you can't make these things happen, you know, in terms of like what happened last year. It was a really unique wave of action. You can plan, you can create communities, you can learn. But the thing that occurred was something that was very unique, and so we're sort of looking at what types of ingredients do you need essentially to be able to create a sort of environment where action can take place in this space. So,
I think especially with how unique the situation was, I think it adds a little bit of how powerful it can be when communities come together to protest against these kinds of issues. Jess, could you speak a little bit on the role of Isla's family in putting together this exhibition and what you have learned from this experience?
Well, I suppose how important it is to kind of work closely with everyone involved. It's such a tender time. It's 1 year on. Which is a huge thing, it's a big thing for everyone, and particularly Isla's family. And so, it's been something that, you know, in the sort of busy life of coordinating and being involved in institution, being involved in the work that we do on a day-to-day basis, we're also having to kind of hold this, an enormous amount of grief, an enormous amount of, you know, big feelings.
Yeah.
At the same time as being kind of weirdly excited about this opportunity to do this again, and sort of always on this bit of a roller coaster, isn't it? Yeah. So I was sort of like, this is exciting. That's not the right word. there's a lot of gravitas. There's a lot of to hold in the space. So
yeah.
I suppose I've learned a lot about sort of navigating that sensitively, I hope. For something that's really living, really live, and still kind of unfolding, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you both hope that audiences will take away from this exhibition and this experience altogether?
I think that one of my biggest takeaways from this, which actually parallels something that I've taken away from this degree as well, which I think is quite circular and beautiful in that sense, is we were taught to analyze an artwork as, I think, in my opinion, a series of decisions made by an artist, and from beginning of their creative process to when you're viewing it. And I think under that lens, I sort of learned that each my micro decision made along the way has the chance to affect the overall impact of the piece and the overall impact that the artist can have on you as the viewer using their piece as a vessel. And I think that is such a relevant way to look at a situation like this, where an incredible, powerful movement was spawned by a series of tiny decisions made by every single person involved, from the first student to take her work down and write that on the wall, to the second person who followed her and made it not just a single action but a movement, and everyone who joined in. It each person played such a crucial role in this big, amazing thing that happened. And I think that one of the biggest inhibitors of important action is feeling powerless and feeling hopeless. And something like this is such a tangible, concrete example of the fact that tiny decisions, or just you have the opportunity every single day to make decisions that could affect the people around you and could create the opportunity for change. And I think that it's been such an honor to be a part of this and actually see not just what happened again under a microscope, but see these students come together and donate their time. A lot of them at the end of their honours year, which is just as, if not more stressful than the year that they were having last year, and give us their time and take the time to write beautiful pieces for this catalogue we've created for the exhibition, or give their artworks back to us for the chance to exhibit them again. And it's, even just working with Jess and what Jess was mentioning about prioritising and honouring everyone's feelings and carrying the weight of such a heavy conversation at the forefront of this project and not prioritising the overall outcome over people's experiences of actually being a part of this as a project and working together and constantly checking in on each other and holding people's feelings and being available to sort of create that space where everyone feels okay and strong enough to keep going.
Yeah.
So it's really been an honour.
Do you have anything?
I feel like for the QVWC, it's, you know, we're an extraordinary venue, an incredible space right in the middle of the city. It's just an extraordinary building with an amazing history and a legacy of women activists that's in the bricks and mortar of that place. And it has a community of extraordinary resident organisations and activations and exhibitions and things kind of happening all the time. And so I'm just sort of really excited to be able to create something where that broader community can come together and over this time, which everyone really generally engages in at the centre, and for people to bring people in, audiences in that we might not have necessarily had in the past.
So, yeah, thank you, Zara and Jess. That was really beautiful. Just to close, do you think we could read a submission from this year for the exhibition?
Sure. So, yeah, this is one of the... We asked students to reflect 1 year on and sort of put pen to paper. It was such a whirlwind, so it was sort of a nice thing for folks to be able to do. And I'd like to read one from Holly Clark Milligan. Offline resistance. As a child, teachers would wax poetic about the power of memory retention through physical note-taking. To read, hear, or even type something would never be as effective as writing something myself. 85. When Ellie Sharon first turned her works over and several other students followed suit, this was the number we wrote on the wall to represent the Australian women murdered in 2024. At the back of my mind, I held a grim awareness that this number may climb by the end of the week. A few days into the protests, a message appeared in the student group chat. Does anybody want me to change their text to 86? 86. There is a vast chasm between recognising the possibility of coming to terms with the reality. The difficulty is only elevated in the intangibility of digital space. In an increasingly online world, it is easy to fall into a sense of satirical empathy. In this sense, the tactility of art making alongside the ritual of writing on the wall and turning works over stands as a rejection of passivity. Though many of us have read the names of the women killed in 2024, it is doubtful we could recollect them like Alba Goody Acho, who wrote the names on the wall of all 86 women. but our hands remember the numbers 85 and 86, and we all remember Isla Bell. Art is not merely a product. Many artists do not fall in love with their art simply for the sake of having something at the end. We are enlivened by the ritual of making. Similarly, protesting is not just an act of displaying information to the world or encouraging action. It is also a manifestation of the need to physically do something, a desperate, relentless in search of conduit. The freedom and ability to protest is essential to the protester as it is to the cause. So write on walls, paint, journal, cook, make signs for protest, make friendship bracelets, draw what you see, think, take a fallen leaf home and photograph it. Fleeting moments, let tangible actions engrave the world upon your mind. This is why art and physical protest are essential and will always matter.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on to the show and speaking with us about this today. It's been really great to have you.
It's such a pleasure.
We've been speaking to co-curators of the exhibition Rest in Power, Jess Hutchinson and Zara O'Day, about the upcoming exhibition, The Connection Between Art and Protest and Discourse Around Gendered Violence.
Accented women.
It seems so obvious to me that if you live in a completely violent cultural milieu, that it's going to translate into every aspect of women's lives.
Accented women.
What's a border? They don't see it like a big wall right along the
How
the
can
country.
People live ordinary lives when they're living in such an extraordinary situation where there are armies there and terrorists there and such conflict every single day of their lives?
Accented women.
A show by and about women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yodiyota, Jajarong, Kalkadoon, and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on the 18th of November. Up next, we'll be speaking to Kath from Defend Dissent. On the 12th of November 2025, the Victorian government introduced the Justice Legislation Amendment Bill, proposing laws that will limit the rights of people during political demonstrations. The proposed new laws will give police additional powers to direct the removal of face coverings, create new offences related to lock-on devices, and restrict protests near places of worship. And Kath will be joining us to discuss the context and impact of these laws. Welcome back to Tuesday Breakfast, Kath. How are you this morning?
I'm great, thank you.
So, yeah, the last time we spoke in March, the anti-protest laws had just been proposed. And now, just last week, it's been introduced and it will be debated today, am I right? Could you give us a recap, perhaps, about what that bill was?
Yeah, so it came about after some of the attacks on synagogues that happened towards the end of last year. Yeah. So the Premier jumped in straight away and connected those attacks somehow to protests, even though there was no evidence that there were people who had been protesting who had done these things, and used those as an excuse to talk about introducing new laws against protests. And it's taken a really, really long time, but we've finally seen these laws in print just over the last few weeks, and they do pretty much all of the things that she was talking about in the first instance, which is allow police to tell anybody at a protest to remove any facial coverings. They make it harder for people to do any sort of protest near a place of worship. And they also introduce new penalties and criminalise further people who have devices or any other strategies that mean they will be immobilised during a protest. So glue, chains, lock-on devices, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, this is coming amid a national crackdown on activism, right? To date, there's about 49 laws, I believe, that's been enacted by governments that are constricting the right to protest over the last 20 years. And a lot of lawyers and activists have already come out to say how this is creating a permissive environment for excessive use of force by police. And of course, one of the key messages for the SNAP rally today is that is precisely that. These new anti-protest laws will simply give police more power and justify this growing state violence that we're already witnessing at protests. Could you, I guess, tell us more about this concern for the misuse of police powers?
Yes, so we have seen a protest over the last little while, particularly here in Melbourne, increasing militarisation of the police and increasing use of force by them. So we just heard a couple of days ago that some people who were at a protest recently are going to sue the police because the police used, like, basically an explosive device against them and injured them. And that shouldn't be happening. And the thing about it is that the police already have more powers than they need to deal with protests. They can already do their designated zone, which they've been doing a lot recently because it's been made easier for them to do that. And once they've got a designated zone, they can tell people to take their masks off. They can do all the stuff that these that this legislation allows them to do. This legislation just makes it very slightly easier for them. And I think that we really need to be keeping an eye on this creeping expansion of police powers because police are not accountable to us. They can go out and do terrible things to people on the street and chances are they won't pay any price for it.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, like you said, they are already misusing the powers they have, right? There's been an IBAC investigations that they are have excessive use of OC spray at protests. You just mentioned earlier, I think in September, the protests in Melbourne, they use stinger grenades, which cause serious injury. And these weapons are becoming increasingly common at protests in Victoria, and they do cause serious injuries and even deaths. So it is very, very concerning that they're thinking that this is the direction we are headed towards. But I guess the further context for all of this is we have to talk about this rise in neo-Nazis organising and gathering in the streets in Victoria, you know, leading and joining rallies calling for a white Australia, vilifying the trans, queer, Jewish, Muslim communities. In light of this, what do you think is the potential impact of the anti-protest laws in terms of countering such movements?
I think that they have very little, will make very little difference because the police already have the powers to deal with these people if they decide they want to. And I think what we saw in New South Wales over the last couple of weeks has been very telling, that the police could have just said, you cannot have your rally to the Nazis in Sydney, but they chose to let them go ahead. So once again, police already have the power to ask people to remove masks. And if they choose not to do that with the Nazis, well, then we have a bigger problem than whether or not the police have enough powers. It's about who they decide to use those powers against.
And what do you think, what do you think would be the actual impact, I guess, of this anti-protest laws for, you know, pro-human rights demonstrators, for people who are opposing the rise of fascism, I guess, on our streets?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that one of the things we know is that there are some communities within our society who are over-policed compared to others, and in particular, First Nations people in Australia are the most over-policed and over-jailed in the world. And we know that every time police get more powers, that that is one of the groups that is going to suffer more as a result of that. We also know that people who are disabled or immunocompromised are going to be less likely to be able to get on the streets if they are worried that they won't be able to wear masks. So it is people who are already vulnerable who are the ones who are going to be impacted the most and the worst by these new laws.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess just specific to the mask as well, like, you know, in the context of the hyper-surveillance of public spaces that we have today, we've, you know, CCTV camera and Victoria Police, you know, they're just constantly filming everyone in public spaces. I think the decision to wear a face covering is in itself a form of political expression, and that that is a protected right, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. People should be able to conceal their identity and they should also be safe from being infected. And I don't know if you were at the Palestine rally a couple of weeks ago when the pollen was being blown around in the hot wind and everybody had tears in their eyes. Like, people should be able to protect themselves from that sort of thing as well.
It's a fundamental, it's a very fundamental right. And exactly what you said, it ends up having people who are immunocompromised or, you know, with medical needs, feeling, you know, that they are not welcome in such spaces or feeling afraid to attend such spaces because they could be asked to remove their facial covering at any point.
And once we start to restrict some people's right to protest, it's such an easy path to then expand that out.
Absolutely. It's the creep, isn't it? Like what you mentioned earlier, the power creep. So obviously you've called for, the Defend Dissent Coalition has called for a snap rally this evening at the Parliament Steps of Victoria. And the last Defend Dissent rally in March saw really powerful cross solidarity, right, from various civil rights groups. We had speakers from the disability justice movement, the refugee rights space, the climate movement. I guess, what would you say to someone who might not be sure if this is their fight?
This is everybody's fight. So you, at the moment, might not feel as though there is an issue that you feel strongly enough about that you want to get out on the streets about.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that next week that the government isn't going to pass some legislation that is directly going to impact you, yeah, and that you want to have your voice heard on that issue. And then suddenly you find, oh, no, hold on a minute, I can't do that because all of these laws have been brought in that make it impossible for me to do this.
Exactly.
Everybody should be defending the right to free speech and to protest. It is fundamental to democracy. If you want things to continue to go in any good direction, which nothing seems to be at the moment,
yeah,
but this is one of the things that we have to draw the line
absolutely
on and say, no,
yes,
you can't take away these rights.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much, Kath. Thanks for joining us today. We'd love to chat more. I'm sure, unfortunately or not, we have to keep chatting more about this. But yeah, great to have you back and hope to hear from you soon. Thanks, Kath.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We've been speaking to Kath, an activist and organizer for the Defend Dissent Coalition, sharing about the anti-protest laws being proposed by Jacinda Allen's government. The Protect Protest Snap Rally will be on today at 5:30 p.m. at the Parliament Steps of Victoria. For more information, please go to @DefendDissentCoalition on Instagram. And that is our show for today. An incredibly busy show. We had people in studio, just always a bit of fun. Before we wrap up the show, just a few events. As mentioned, there's the SNAP rally this evening at 5:30 to protest, to protect our right to protest at the Parliament Steps. There's also an Australian Super Lunchtime Vigil at 1:30 Lonsdale Street at 12:30 p.m. today. On Thursday, 20th November, there's a Timor-Leste Solidarity Night at Victoria Trades Hall, 6 p.m. On Friday, as mentioned earlier, is the Queer Punk Fundraiser for Switchbot. That'll be at Cafe Gamo from 8 to 11:30 p.m. And then on Saturday, the 22nd of November, that would be the Trans Day of Resistance, which will start at 2 p.m. at Flinders Street Station. And of course, the continued rally against CoHealth closures. That's on Sunday at CoHealth Fitzroy at 1 p.m. So to wrap us up, this was the show we've had today. At 7:15, we had Jay Underwood, the music manager and community connector behind Liberate, a grassroots initiative, speaking about the fundraising event for Switchbot this Friday. And then at 7:30, we were joined by Juliette Lamont, who spoke about the use of IOF, the IOF's use of F-35 jets and the parts of these weapons that are being produced at Farah Engineering in Brisbane. At 7:45, we listened to Sophie Ellis sharing with us about the new Adult Time for Violent Crime Bill and how this law will harm young people in Victoria.
At 8 o'clock, we were joined by Jess Hutchinson and Zara O'Day about the RMIT exhibition Rest in Power.
And finally, at 8:15, we spoke to Kath from Defend Dissent Coalition discussing the new anti-protest laws that's being debated in Parliament today. And that's all we have for you today on our show. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for Accent of Women coming up next.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.